I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
If you're working as an accountant and you lose your job, nobody really notices.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Lowe!
Rugby Weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh!
Oh! Magic!
Hello and welcome to the 42 Rugby Weekly Extra. I'm Murray Kinsale. I hope everyone had a beautiful weekend. Lovely weather out there. Definitely good for the soul. No doubt some of you tuned in to more of the NRL Rugby League in Australia over the weekend. I know I did. But we're only 11 days away now from Super Rugby in New Zealand getting underway again. And a couple of interesting law variations announced today. First and foremost, red carded players are going to be able to be replaced after 20 minutes. So that's going to be really interesting to see how that affects the game. And on top of that, they're going to use a golden point system after games that have drawn in the regular 80 minutes to decide the winner. So lots to look forward to on the pitch very soon. But today we're going to have a chat with George Murray, who's the head performance analyst for Munster. He's been with the province for 18 years now, having joined after being a rugby development officer with Leinster. He was an AIL player with Greystones and Shannon, and he's also coached with the likes of Brough, Shannon, Richmond and UL Bows. So loads of strands to his rugby intellect. Hope you enjoy the chat. Munster into an off-season now, three-week off-season, but it has been obviously a busy time in lockdown and a very different time for everyone, players especially, trying to get used to staying focused and training away. What's it been like for you as a performance analyst in this period?
Yeah, it's been completely different than what you're used to. You actually have a bit of time to sit back and reflect on I suppose, your processes. Time that you certainly don't get in any other year that I've been involved in professional sport. You just don't get that length of time to, especially without an end goal in sight. So I suppose reflection's been the key for us, just to sit back and say, what processes are we doing? Are they working? If we had a blank sheet again, where would we start? Along with that, also actually just going out and talking to other people in other sports and researching and seeing, I suppose, as a performance department, how we can be better when we do get back playing. So I suppose that isolation and that time while you're always working, it's very much different work for us.
How open is the environment between departments, as you say, in different clubs, in different unions, even in different sports?
I think there's a line that everybody has where you don't cross and ask the actual, you know, secrets of a club, of how they play or how they plan. But I think finding technical information and some of the work process, like I spoke about there, just asking them what their processes are, and particularly in different sports, obviously it's much easier to go a little bit further in depth with the IP stuff. So I think anybody I've spoken to has been very open. I like to be pretty open to a point, because you're going to get that back if you open yourself up to new ideas, if you open yourself up to releasing, I suppose, some of your ideas to other teams, and they'll answer back to you with a little bit of honesty and truth backwards.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely works both ways. I was really interested to ask you about Claire Muirin Murphy, the storyteller that you did a bit of work with. And I know you mentioned some of the stuff on the Munster Rugby website, but it's a fascinating avenue, I suppose, to go down. How relevant was it for coaches?
Hugely relevant, Murray. I'll tell you how it got started. We were doing a conference with a bunch of analysts from all around the world, from Southern Hemisphere, Rugby League, Rugby Union, hockey, everybody. I think there's about 50 of us on it. And Claire was one of the guest speakers, and she only had a 10-minute window to speak. And then we had lots of breakout rooms, but just in that 10 minutes, she struck a chord with some of the things that I like to see and associate with, and that's getting the right message across to players from a coach's or an analyst point of view, because the players are so many different types of personalities in that 40, 50 man group in a room, and there's so many different ways of learning and taking in that message. So it's something that I've been spending a lot of time researching and looking into, and trying to help our coaches understand a little bit more about. And even in Claire's, just that 10 minute of telling us what storytelling is, the history of storytelling, and how powerful it is, a tool of carrying a strong message. I suppose she said, I think it was the second longest or second oldest form of communication, the storytelling, outside of singing. So, and the key is that, you know, I suppose when you're growing up, you always remember a good story, whether it's your grandfather, your teacher. And I suppose that struck a chord was to try and delve into that a little bit more. So I kind of got in touch with Claire after that conference, reached out to her a little bit, spent an hour just myself talking to her, trying to find out a bit more from her background, and particularly what she's worked with. You know, she's worked with a lot of scientists at NASA, who kind of, I suppose her main aim was to try and help those people who probably have all the ideas and the best, you know, discoveries, but probably don't have the personality necessarily to deliver it to a board or to a committee or you know, to an investment group. And her job was kind of to help facilitate the learning for them to put their story together to a bigger audience, you know. And then I asked Johan, would he be keen to have a chat, give him an outline of what I've learned from it, and he jumped all over. And I think all our coaches, we jumped on a call, we spent 2 hours talking to Claire. And she, I suppose, you know, we're going to do something a little bit more down the track because, there's a learning cycle to it, and she wants to teach individuals how to be better speakers publicly. But I suppose what we delved into was like storytelling through the mythology of Ireland, you know, the Fianna and Fionn MacCool and stuff like that. I mean, there's powerful storytelling in Ireland in itself. So, yeah, I could keep going on and on about that one, Murray, but it's, I think, while it's completely outside the realm of rugby, I think the whole thing of sitting in a week, you know, having maybe 20 meetings with players right through that week is like, how do you make that message last and stand and make sure when, you know, you're in the heat of battle that the key message is retained?
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking to Ronan O'Gara about Crusaders, it seems like teams are a massive part of what they do and getting meaning in the group. Is that the kind of thing that maybe, well, all environments really can benefit from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, Crusaders are renowned for their theming of their seasons, and most of the New Zealand sides do it. I mean, I'm not, you know, not naive enough to say, like, I mean, every club in Europe is probably doing it as well. We certainly are. And it's just to give that picture of, you know, you're going into a season, give it a little bit of a theme so you can start basing your results or your, you know, your fitness scores or your battle plan going into a game, basing around an image so it will last for that player. But I think what I learned from Claire was that, you know, sometimes stories just need to have a continuation, you know, like rather than just being one season, one theme, and then that's forgotten about. I think, you know, as she's talking about that, Nafina and stuff like that, the multitude of mythology stories in Ireland, there's actually a lot to be learned about just continuing and creating a story that has a little bit more longevity to it rather than just stops at the end of a season. Let's find another one, because that become a little bit monotonous as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. You could talk about that specifically for hours, and I can imagine the value you got out of it. In terms of the rugby stuff over the last number of weeks, last couple of months now at this stage, a number of the players have mentioned having little projects they've been given to work on. What kind of stuff has been the focus there?
I think we stepped back originally from video footage and rugby learning. We just wanted the guys to adapt to life, basically to the lifestyle they're going to have. And I suppose mentally and physically, that was something that was a challenge for them. So we didn't want to overpower them with anything from a video or performance analysis point of view. It was really just get the physical stuff, like the athletic performance, correct, so they could maintain their athletic readiness to play. So that was the main focus for the first few weeks, and also mentally, just to be able to, you know, I suppose better their environment. Then we obviously didn't know if we were going to have when the season was going to return, if it was going to return. So we were basing everything on the basis that, yeah, look, in a month's time, we're going to get back playing again. So we then gradually started drip feeding, you know, 1 week was attack, 1 week was defense, another week was kicking. And just to keep that brain from a rugby perspective ticking over, we all then as coaching groups and analysts went off and looked at our own departments and our own areas and done a research project and presented back to the whole group, not the playing group, but the management group on our own areas, just for, I suppose, our own upskilling and but also upskilling the other staff on what we do and what, you know, so Steve presented to everybody, I presented to everybody, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, from a player's point of view, a lot of the academy guys went off profiling individual players from World Rugby and posting them up on Huddle and doing little video editing projects, but also getting a bit of feedback from the academy coaches and senior coaches on what they've learned. And Murray, the key with this is that it's not just empty work. It's that it actually leads to something from a development point of view, because what we didn't want to do was give everybody projects just to be ticking a box and taking up time. I had to have a purpose to it and a development purpose for the player.
Yeah, absolutely, and really beneficial. I'm imagining you were delighted to see the NRL return. I think you're a bit of a fan.
Yeah, no, massive fan. I actually watched a lot of rugby league when I was younger, probably more rugby league than rugby union originally. But I reached out to Paul Devlin because Paul was obviously a player here in Munster, and I was pretty close to him when he was here as a player, and he's doing a great job down in Brisbane Broncos with Anthony Seabolt. So I just reached out to him because, again, like everything, we were looking at their window when they were going to return. They probably had a 3 to 4 week window when they were able to get into four or five groups of four and five, and then slowly introduce contact rugby again. So I suppose the key thing was to figure out, how have they managed their players from an analysis point of view and a mental point of view, and then obviously you go a little bit further to have a look at physically how they recondition guys to get back in and play. So Paul was the perfect man for that. He was nicely placed. He ran their athletic development program. He got a few other people on calls that we could chat to from our own departments. And then we opened up a little bit further, a bit like Claire's story. I reached out originally and saw it was the right avenue to go down. And then we got the coaches involved as well and their coaches. And we zoomed back and forth to bounce ideas off each other, which is brilliant. They wanted to talk to us about long seasons, about rotations of squads and how you manage players in and out over, let's say, an 18, 20 week block, which they've never done before. But now with the nature of the position we're in, they have to run two seasons concurrent for the next 18 weeks, which they've never had to do before. So they wanted to delve into how we'd manage players during an 18 week season. I think they got a bit of info from that. They lost their first game, unfortunately, but I think we learned a lot. Just really, it's particularly if you got a 3 week window, how to get guys physically and contact ready for playing again. That was the big thing we wanted to get out of it,
Yeah, it's a massive challenge. Listen, I'm keen to obviously talk about your role as it is now. Excuse me. I'm keen to talk about your role as it is now, and it's obviously an all-encompassing role. There's so many strands to it, but maybe take us back to 2002 when this first started for you with Munster. What was the picture like back then? Because obviously this is a massive part of the game now, but I'm imagining that it wasn't quite there in 2002.
No, it was very different. I actually recently had an attic clean out, and I was throwing out, I think I had 6 or 7 VHS recorders. So that was kind of wow. a bit of a throwback to what it was like. So today, like I started, I was working with the development office in Leinster in around 2000, 2001. Kind of that's where I got to know Alan Gaffney and pretty closely. I was playing out in Greystones, and he was doing a bit of coaching out there. So he kind of started me on the path of just watching tapes, giving me loads of old Ranwick tapes. And my pastime was just kind of watching those and giving him a bit of cutting them up for him. And then, I was doing a couple of hours for the Leinster team back then with Brett Igo, was the senior analyst with Leinster at that point. And he took me on for a few hours a week. So that's kind of where it started. And actually, funny enough, I was heading over to Australia to take up a kind of a player coaching type job over there. And then Alan had sorted me out a visa to go to Australia. Hmm. He actually thought I'd taken the flight and I was gone. And then I went down to an under-15s game in Donnybrook and bumped into Alan. He said, I thought you were gone. Would you come down to Cork and advertise or, apply for the analysis role? So next day I was on a train down to Cork to meet Gareth Fitzgerald. So if I didn't go to that under-14s match, I probably wouldn't be where I am now.
Yeah, it was meant to be.
But like VHS tapes, Murray, that was the way it was. I mean, no Sky Plus. I had my family running around recording one game. I think I got a satellite installed with Canal Plus down the house that I was living in Limerick. So I was kind of meeting in Port Leash or wherever I could, meeting 5 or 6 different family members, getting VHS tapes off them on a Sunday morning, coming back, spending most of the day Sunday cutting them up for Alan. So it was a very different and much, much harder route.
Yeah. What did you learn from Alan about the role you do and about rugby, I guess?
Oh, Alan's a detailed, very detailed coach. What I learned from him was the patience of sitting through watching games for 6, 7, 8 hours a day and really counting numbers, looking at the you know players in certain positions and where those players ended up after 4, 5, 6, 7 phases, and you know, not watching rugby as a spectacle, but really, really watching it in detail and mapping different opposition out. That was Alan's skill. He knew the game. He knew the running lines. So learning off a kind of, I suppose, a master in that sense. Alan was extremely analytical. You know, one of the most influential people I've ever had work with, have had the luxury of working with, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you've done it for 18 years now, just over even. How often has the role and the responsibility shifted and changed? Is that a very much a product of who's the coach? When someone new comes in, does everything change and you go back to the drawing board, or how much of a progression is it in that sense?
Yeah, it's over time. There's a trust built up that if you've got a good department working, you've got a good process in place and workflow for the coaches. There's a natural kind of trust. But then obviously any coach will come in and want to put his angle and spin on it. And I think the key to any analysis department is you have to adapt to those coaches because that's who you serve. You know, we are a service provider to the team and a service provider to the coaches, the coaching group. And I think you always got to remind yourself of that. You know, we're not the master of how the team should go just from an analytical point of view. It's we have to adapt and learn new styles off any coach that comes in and help facilitate their philosophy and their plan. So, you know, I think that's a skill in itself, is that you can't be, I suppose, you can't be so confident in what you're doing is absolutely right. You've got to be willing to learn off someone new, learn new ideas, branch out there and adapt that to how you work. Because I think if you cocoon yourself in and say, look, oh no, this is how I do it, this is the only way to do it, well then, you know, you're probably... you're hiding yourself away from new ideas and open yourself up to how the game is developing.
Yeah. Do all coaches value performance analysis as highly as each other, or is that very much a varying degree?
I think less so now, Murray. I think coaches nowadays are hugely reliant on the performance analysis department. I suppose that because we'd like to have the analysis department be much more dynamic than not pigeonholing themselves into just being stats department, or not pigeonholing, you know, just somebody at the side there will hold a camera, for example. I think we're much more rounded in the sense that we have to be out there recording training sessions from multiple angles, piecing that together, giving those to players, giving those to coaches. But we also need to be able to interpret the stats and interpret the way the game is flowing to give them backup information. So I think you can go two ways with it. You can be just a service provider that records training session and hands it to the coaches, and then you don't do any type of analysis. Are you just the numbers department who are completely analytical around numbers, but aren't able to turn those numbers into a story or something that the player or the coaches will understand? So I think what we pride ourselves on is that we're very strong rugby, have a strong rugby knowledge, strong rugby background, but also have to be strong in the number side of things. And merging those two together, then the coaches can get a little bit of trust and come to you and say, look, where's the game going? What are you seeing? So you can turn those numbers into a visual as well.
Yeah, the number side of it was something I wanted to ask you about. It's fascinating and I'm always curious. And obviously, as you mentioned, you can't fully pull back the curtain, but how big a part of that has it become? And I mean, is that your own data that Munster produces? Are you relying on third parties to produce those numbers? How big a field is it now? Because I guess you can look at so many different things.
Yeah, and your last thing you said, Murray, so many different things. That's the key. There is absolutely so much out there. And the key for us is, again, going back to that simple messaging. We don't expect the coaches to be able to read up on all these numbers. We have to do that job for them. We have to then produce something that's key. I suppose from either an opposition point of view or our own team performance point of view. We have thousands and thousands of reams of data coming in from either Opta, Stats, our own stuff that we do internally, and then even the athletic performance department from, you know, GPS, etc. So it's a wash with information. What is key is that you whatever you produce has to drive performance change within the environment we're in. I suppose so. We're there to dilute all that data down to a simple key message to the coaches. Now, what the forms that comes in is many different things. So whether it's a post-match performance report, whether it's an opposition scouting report, whether it's a training trend analysis, and then obviously you've got your individual development performance plans. So each player will statistically code them after every game, not just to give them the video footage and the statistics for performance, but also to see how they're tracking in a certain area over time, and to try and pinpoint where they need to develop. But I think the important thing is from stats is, particularly on data, is that every team is going to be different. And I think you need to find the data that drives the best performance for your team. So you're not always reflecting on what other this opposition are good at this, that opposition are good at that. We need to do this and we need to do that, because for want of a better way of describing, you're chasing your own tail a bit then. So I think identifying, you know, where the coaches want to bring the team in a year's time, 2 years' time, or 3 years' time, find what drives that team from a performance statistical point of view, and then really, really making everybody accountable for those stats. I think certainly my point of view over the years that I've done this, I find that you can be always searching for that stat, and everybody's saying, what is the biggest stat in the game right now? There is no stat that's going to say this is going to win you the game. But I think if you can pick four or five that drive you as the team, you know, best performance for your team, well then I think that's a stat that you can use to empower change.
Yeah, absolutely. We've kind of discussed coaches, and I definitely want to speak about some of the specific people you've worked with, but just to touch on the players, how has that side of it changed? Because I guess we came from a point where players weren't doing a lot of analysis, then, you know, players like Paul O'Connor studying every single clip they get their hands on. What's it like now? Everyone talks about this generation and attention spans and things like that, how they interpret information. What's it like to work with the younger player coming through now in terms of that analysis?
I think you ought to get the balance, Murray. You know, there's still very analytical people out there in rugby. There's guys that want to sit back and just see it. So a little bit like what I was saying, you've got to cater for everybody. So you've got to find a way. And if that's 20 meetings a week, which it certainly isn't, but let's say it's 10 meetings a week, you've got to find little new ways of presenting that be it visual or textual data back to the players, that one group of players that, you know, visually want to see it, make sure that they're stimulated. And then the other people that want graphs and, you know, want numbers, which are very few, want that. But also some people that when they arrive at the training ground, they just want to get in training and they want to, you know, digest the information later on. So pumping it out to their phones, you know, whether it's just training footage or whether it's an individual clip of two or three of the top players from the upcoming opposition, or, you know, whether it's Andrew Conway puts together a little back three club and analyzes the back three players in the kicking game of the opposition the night before a match, for example. Everybody has their little way that makes them, you know, think of their performance or get themselves ready to perform. So we need to be very flexible in that front. We need to be able to, you know, if a player wants to see it at 10 o'clock the night before a match, we have to be there ready to do that. If a player wants to do it earlier in the week. So for example, some of the best people that I've came across, like, you know, someone like a Darren O'Shea in Munster, you know, Darren wasn't always being picked for the team, but Darren wanted a laptop every Sunday morning to analyse the upcoming opposition's lineouts. So he, on a Monday morning, he'd be ready to run the opposition lineouts, even if he felt, look, you know, I could be pissed off here that I'm not being picked. He was selfless. He made sure that he was ready and the starting team was ready because he was doing his analysis. So, you know, you have to be ready to cater for everybody. I spent a bit of time over in the Golden State Warriors, Murray, last summer, and, you know, they have a thing where they bring in a lot of vets, three vets every couple of years to be ready for NBA playoffs, and they learn very differently from the younger guys in the group. But what they maintained was every meeting they present three messages in three different ways. So it could be a video clip, it could be a press clipping, and it could be something funny, as long as the message is retained. So you do have to cater for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. There's balance to all sides of this. I'm curious about the current setup and Johan and his approach to the game, and especially now with Stephen adding his level of influence. Has that been, I guess, a learning experience for you with those? I know Razzie was there before, but with those different cultures maybe of Aussie and South African rugby kind of blending together?
It certainly is. The good thing about the coaches that we have here now, they're young, aspiring, ambitious coaches who are absolutely, you know, how would I describe it? They are, they just love the game. They just absolutely love the game. They're always bouncing ideas off each other. They're students of the game. You know, Johan worked as an analyst. JP worked as an analyst. Steve is a real strong numbers guy as well. You know, so I suppose to answer your question, it hasn't been a challenge because it's a really dynamic area that coaching, whether it's in the box or whether it's in the coach's room in the morning when we're planning. Even Graham's got so much experience and seen so many different ways of doing things. It's actually so refreshing to see guys bouncing ideas off each other, talking about small things in the game for long times. So in my opinion, it's actually incredibly refreshing to see guys that are so hungry to learn new things amongst each other.
Yeah, you mentioned experience there, and I'm curious that you probably provide that as well with the coaching group. It's funny, it'll flash up to the coach's box, and often the coach's head coach or whoever it is will be the one who's quite animated, but the analyst will always be quite calm and focused on the laptop in front of them. Is that maybe your role, to provide that information that sometimes soothes them a little bit?
I'd love to say I'm calm as well, Murray, but I'm not.
You look calm. No,
maybe the camera's going at the right time. I like to see the game a little bit different and take my eye on. When I'm watching the game, I'm you know, certainly from the coach that we're working with now, is to try and be a solutions-based person up there. So the coaches can say to me, look, I expect Johan's eye to be on the big picture and Steve's is on attack, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, they expect to ask me a question and me to go back and put my head in the computer, watch a certain passage of play back and forth. Where they can't do that, they've got to keep their eye on the game at that point. And then when the game stops, I have to give them accurate information immediately back. So sometimes that has to be a solutions-based thinking. So look, you know, if we're watching a game, we say, look, they're getting so much fastball. How can we stop it? Well, the game is continuing on. I've got to put my head back in that laptop and start figuring out why they're getting so much fastball. Is it a certain thing that we're doing? Is it a certain thing that they're doing? And what ways can we prevent that? So when that stoppage in play, you've got to be very distinct in what you're providing back, whether it's a small bit of information just by verbalizing it, or whether it's a clip that absolutely cements the answer back to the coaches. Then that gets processed by the coaches and gets fed back down into a plan, an action plan immediately. So yeah, it's the coaching box in itself is a busy environment, but there is a bit of shouting, and that's natural because you want, you know, I think Rassi was the one who said, you know, you got to be part of the game. You got to be part of the game. If you're not part of the game, you're not engaged in it. So there's one extreme to the other. I think the balance is that you are on task. That's the thing. You're always on task and you avoid commentary of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rassi is certainly one who is definitely involved in the game and provides lots of kind of highlight moments when the coach cam comes up.
But it's brilliant, Murray. He's exactly that, but he's animated, but he's mentally totally engaged in the game. You know, that's just his way of processing. And there's no right or wrong, in my opinion, up there. But as long as you are processing with a solution mindset, you know, to make actionable change, whether it's at halftime or a substitute, etc., well, there shouldn't be any right or wrong as long as you're getting more right than wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And he certainly has in the recent past. How important or how focused is it in game? Because, I mean, there's so many things you can look at. There's so much that you can try and see. But as you mentioned before, you can't get everything.
Yeah, I think that goes back to, again, how you plan during the week and what the philosophy is or the game plan for that week. So if you can stay aligned and not deviate too much of what your plan was earlier in the week, well, then you can actually watch the game from an accountability point of view and see from your own performance, where is that going, what you've worked on all week. The opposition will always change. You know, you may watch opposition for 2-3 weeks in a row and they're setting you up. You know, so that happens, and you have to have that little that little space for adaption amongst that, because, you know, every team does it. They're coming into a big game. They'll show different pictures on purposely. So if you go into watch a line out live in a game, it could be defended completely different than what you've seen for 3 weeks in advance. So you have to, I think, most importantly, stay on what value drives your game. If you go back to what I was saying about the stats and the and what drives your own performance, if you can have that mindset going into a game and watch body language, watch your own performance and be accountable for that, well then you still have a better handle on the game rather than being completely opposition reliant.
Mm, that's fascinating to think of teams trying to set you up and trying to figure out what's a trap and what's not. That's fascinating. You mentioned Razzie there. I was curious to ask what you learned from him and Jacques, who are two obviously World Cup winners now, but what stood out to you about that period and what you learned?
Infectious simplicity would probably be a way of summarizing it, and that means something to me right now. I'll try to explain what that means. Their coaching is infectious, just their personality, the how they deliver messages, how they are in game and how they are about certain points, or fixing things in review, for example. They're just infectious in how they present it and how they believe in what they're doing. They're simple in what they want from the game, and they're simple in what they want from the player. But they deliver that message with an absolute, responsibility on people delivering. And I think that's why they get teams working. Teams that are struggling a small bit, they give them a simple game plan, but with infectious coaching that everybody buys into and gets on board with. I think that's key.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does come across that way. And certainly when you speak to players who've learned from them, it seems like simple things they learn, but done really consistently and done really well, particularly defensively. Even for, I think it was Ron O'Mahony explained to me that Jacques gave him a simple system for when to shoot off the edge, and kind of transformed his game. Your own coaching in the IL, how, and I asked this question two ways, I guess, how useful is your role for that coaching in terms of what you're learning about the game there? And then the other way around, in terms of actually improving your work as a performance analyst, how valuable has your coaching experience been?
Yeah, well, not to sound like I'm the world's greatest coach right now, but I started coaching when I was about 16, 17 in school, coaching first years and stuff like that. So it was my real first love of rugby was coaching. So I always wanted to stay involved in it, and people like Gareth Fitzgerald, Alan Gaffney, guys like that always encouraged me to do it. But I suppose the one thing I learned from Alan was B1. There's lots of people, I was thinking about going down the coaching route, staying in analysis, but don't be both. I think Alan gave me that advice a long time, was try and be the best at one of those things, but don't don't mix the two of them up and be half good at one, So obviously I wanted to be the best analyst that I could be. So coaching was only something that I pushed on the side. But staying in it was important for me because I had such a love for it. And things that I was seeing in the professional game, trying to pass that on to younger guys at club level. The only way to describe it is something that I love doing. So, I always wanted to keep at it. On the other side, then, when you come into the high performance or into the professional realm, just being able to describe things to coaches that you've done during the week, when you see something about developing a skill session or developing a certain type of plan around, let's say, breakdown, you can always go, actually, I've done that last week. Very similar thing. I was trying to do the same thing at club level last week, and this didn't work as a drill because of the speed and the timing. And being able to say that to a coach, he's actually done it, something similar to it, and they'll take that on board. So as well as that, I like to actually practice some of the things that we're trying to do going forward as a team to see if they'll work. I've tried the teams that I've gone into, tried to look at different ways, maybe evolving what we're doing at Munster, maybe, 6 or 7 months down the track to see how they work out. So that actually gives me a little mindset when I can still talk to Steve and say, look, I've actually tried that. I think, or he'll say to me, what about trying this? I said, look, I might give that a go this weekend and see how it goes. But it's just exciting to be able to do those things, and staying in touch with rugby, not just numbers, keeping the mind ticking over about actually, getting out, talking to players, keeping the mind ticking over around how certain things will work if you try them. I think it works really well together.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a really great overlap there. You mentioned earlier on maybe a bit of the, I think you term it best practice research. How big a part of the role is that in terms of watching what else is going on around the world? I'm imagining you don't have a huge amount of time because you obviously spend so much time on Munster and focusing there and training, etc. What part of the role is that, looking elsewhere?
Oh, it's a huge part, Murray. I think anytime you have those windows where Super Rugby starts up or Currie Cup starts up, whatever it may be, Six Nations, you'd be foolish not to study those games and see where the game is going. So I tend to write a report to the coaches and give them a little bit of statistical feedback on each tournament, and also kind of look at certain parts of the game that don't show up in statistics, but that teams are doing. But coaches are doing that anyway themselves. So we'll always have a little get together every couple of months after big competitions when the windows allow it and outside of our competitions to say, okay, Super Rugby is going this way, Six Nations have gone that way. It's not something we can just implement into our game in reaction to a certain tournament, because it's probably not the right time to say, okay, well, look, this, England done this in the Six Nations, Ireland done this in the Six Nations, we should do that because it worked for them. Because that's probably taken them 18 months to build into or get to anyway. Mm. So just implementing a certain thing from a tournament, it's a dangerous thing to do as well, because you take your eye off where your progression as a team is going.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the things that stood out to you then in terms of the World Cup probably? And we had a shortened Six Nations, obviously, but there was a nice bit of material there. What are the things standing out to you in Test rugby that are maybe increased trends or really valuable parts of the game now?
Well, look, the obvious ones are still around the kicking game and the roles of people within the kicking game. Look, you can use GPS and you can use a number of different things to measure certain values, but kicking's still a huge part of any game. And even if you look at Super Rugby, the teams that have won down there have also kicked the ball, but it's not about kicking the ball in a defensive mindset or a defensive manner. It's, can you get the ball back and cause the game to become unstructured? Because defenses are so well structured these days. That the more you can make the game unstructured, the more possibility you have of breaching. So there's lots of different trends around kicking, where teams are kicking from, the variety of kicks they have, because certainly if you've got a variety of kick, when you analyse that team from a defensive point of view, you're then unsure whether you need to hold back maybe three players in the backfield, or do you put them, have 14 players in the front line. They don't kick that often. So teams that have much more variation in their kicking game and kick when you least expect them to kick, they're the hardest teams to analyse. So keeping your eye on that, you take teams like Racing, they score so many tries from attacking kicks and kicks in your own half. And some people, if you're commentating on the game, some people go, oh, they've had to kick it away. But it's actually what's happened in maybe the passage later from that, because it's pressure. So, if you hold on to the ball, certain stats in the game will show that if you hold on to the ball for 6 or 7 phases or a certain amount of time within your own half or just around a halfway line, you're more likely to turn the ball over. And that, that's effectively pressure back on you. But actually, when you kick proactively in the opposition's half, that's pressure on the opposition to exit and exit and exit again. So, every team is employing that type of mindset. Well, not every team is employing, but certainly that's the way the game is going. And then obviously all that is still kick execution and individual brilliance. You take Racing, score some incredible tries from kicks. The difficulty is with teams like that and Crusaders and stuff, you don't know if they're running or kicking it. So yeah. There's some of the main things that you can pick up on.
Yeah, absolutely. And the box in England even have shown that value of kicking to put that pressure on and relieve the pressure on yourself in that area of the pitch. I think the box probably kick out of their half every single time in the World Cup after a couple of phases where they didn't get that run success.
Yeah, they're probably mainly just, a lot of their thing is about retaining energy and not wasting energy playing in your own half. And so when you do get that ball back off a ball that's knocked down or scrapped around the breaking of it, that then they can light up and have much more energy in attack and not waste so much energy in your own half defending.
Yeah. Are you a fan of the 50-22 proposal?
I think definitely, yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to add a little bit of spice to it, isn't it? Certainly from an attacking perspective, then you're going to be forced to have more people backfield, which is going to open a little bit of space in the front line. So, look, we're not judges of where the game has to go. We've got to trust the people that are putting these things in place and back their instinct on it. So, I think the good thing about rugby, we've always been willing to give things a try and see it, and they've always been pretty willing to take it away if it's not working. So I think no fear that the right people are making these decisions.
Absolutely. In terms of performance analysis, when you look forward, where do you think this is going to go and develop? And are there new technologies you can see becoming more prevalent, or is it refining the art even more? How do you see it developing in the next?
Yeah, I don't see the game as a product on the pitch changing too much. I think from a performance analysis point of view, I think it's mainly focused around recovery, player recovery, injuries, concussions, all those different types of things, how technology can advance that and help that whole process. I think that's going to be the key area. And then from a statistical point of view, you've got a lot of things like machine learning, certain AI stuff that's given us more automated information. I think that stuff, that's the areas we're going down. Things like holograms, etc. You know, VR, we're looking into all that type of thing. Obviously, budgets depending, decide where you can go with certain things. But a lot of companies are willing to get involved with rugby teams and soccer teams, particularly some of the areas that we're researching is around guys coming back with certain types of injury. How can they mentally develop their game and be ready to hit the ground running when they return from injury? Because, you know, as you know yourself, it does take quite a while to get from, you know, if it's a 6 month injury, your first game, you know, when are you going to get to that peak performance again? That could be 5-6 games in. But everybody wants that player ready on week one. So it's looking at different ways to get that player in, whether he's got a lower limb injury, can't do it, but he can use his evasion for his upper body and start fending people through a VR headset, those type of things. Whether it's preparing a team for cognitive awareness, for space, etc., using holograms and stuff like that. So again, that can be where it goes, Murray, but I suppose you got to get that balance right, that it's not just a gimmick, that it's actually performance enhancing. And it's not just a gimmick that we throw in there because it looks good.
It'll be fascinating to see how that technology is harnessed. And you even see in a couple of other sports, they've already kind of embraced that a little bit. Let me finish by asking you a kind of indulgent last question for the people who are listening, because a lot of our listeners are kind of students of the game. What would you say to people who are looking to maybe watch with a deeper level of understanding, as you say, not just watching rugby as a series of events? What are little things people can maybe appreciate a little bit more that are undervalued in terms of assessing games and players and things like that?
I think, I suppose, if you speak at a simple level, is watch the reaction of players off the ground, where they get to, where they chase kicks, where they maneuver themselves into certain positions in defense lines, so they're, you know, certain players aren't as vulnerable. So certainly those actions, and again, look, I suppose I'm saying that because we have the luxury of multiple angles, so we see it regularly. But if we were to, I'm the worst person in the world to watch a match within a pub, because I'm usually watching different things and saying something to a friend of mine, look, that's going to happen now, and it inevitably happens, and they get shut up. But I think certainly look at people's reaction, where they get to when they're getting up off a tackle, getting out of a ruck, where they certain players position themselves, or how quick they get to position themselves. I suppose the other things. The other things I like to see is, what happens on the outcome of a possession. So let's say a team has a line out and they go three phases and kick. But have a look where they get to and how that happens maybe three or four phases later to our next possession, where the outcome starts again. So, for example, we could have a line out on our halfway line and run a certain play and end up back in our own half and have to kick on the back foot, for example. So maybe stop, if you're watching a game, have a look at where the outcome happens, maybe where the opposition have their next possession. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And not necessarily what you've done with your possession, because the game is about pressure and going forward. And sometimes that happens in many, many different ways, whether it's kicking, running, or whatever. So I love watching the game in the sense of, like, they run a certain play and people perceive it. Oh, that wasn't great because they had to kick at the end of it. But, you know, 1 to 2 minutes later, after the opposition ran a certain play, where are Munster then in that position? Because that's a direct reflection of actually how that previous possession was working.
Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating. There's many different ways to watch it, but your enthusiasm definitely is rubbing off here. Listen, I really appreciate you giving us the insight. It's been really fascinating, and thanks a million for giving up your time. I know when you're heading into your off season, so best luck and enjoy all that.
Thanks, Murray. Pleasure talking to you. Happy to do it again.
Yeah, great stuff from George. Thanks to him. And thanks to everyone, as always, for listening. We're back on Thursday with the regular podcast. So chat to you then.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
If you're working as an accountant and you lose your job, nobody really notices.
Leinster could offer me 5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Moe!
Rugby Weekly.
Little reverse pass, hit it!